Backstage with Robert Emery.
Hello and welcome to episode number 4 of Backstage with me, Robert Emery. Today's show features the incomparable, eccentric, and at times outrageous Hollywood star of yesteryear, Sarah Miles. It's a fairly long chat, and I do advise you to stick with it. We take a while to warm up, but Sarah has led really the most incredible life, and once it gets going, there's some astonishing revelations. I try to cover everything from crop circles and what she really thinks of urine therapy, through to her love affair with Sir Laurence Olivier, being related to the royal family, and a really difficult discussion that involves a fateful night in 1973, Burt Reynolds, a suicide, or was it murder, with Sarah, even though proven innocent, being accused the murderess, which in fact may have killed off her career. I do warn you, there are some very explicit stories in here, but when listening, if anything makes you feel uncomfortable, I really hope you continue listening to the end. Sarah hasn't had what you'd call a normal life, and therefore some of her thoughts, opinions, and life experiences have been polar opposite of normal. Yet underneath, she's a wonderful, kind-hearted woman who's fascinating to speak with. So without more rabble from me, here is a sneak into the life of actress and writer, Sarah Miles.
Thanks, Jeeves. Jeeves. What would I do without him? Right, now we're calm. Deep breathe.
Okay.
And we're off.
Hello, 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 Sarah.
Hello, hello, hello there, Robert.
Thank you for joining me today. So we're sitting here in your beautiful manor house. And the first thing I just want to ask and have a quick chat about is it's such an unusual house. It's very old. How old is it? Old.
It's 1078, if you can imagine that. 8 years after William the Conqueror. That's this end. The other end is 14th.
Wow. And there's a special sort of window in here, isn't there? There's a special...
There is. The first window ever in England, which was the overflow of Hampton Court. And that was given here because the owner at the time was his silk merchant, the king's silk merchant on the Silk Road. And he came back with such fine silks for the king that the king honoured him with the window.
And so it's the first ever window in a private house in England.
Yes,
I see.
Yes.
And not in a palace.
Yes. Ah. From the overflow of they were putting them in Hampton Court for the first time. Mm.
And how long have you been here?
32 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the smallest manor in England, I want to state.
Yes, yes.
It's not a huge, great place at all.
No, it's not.
It's like a big cottage, you know.
It is like a big cottage. And it's got very, very low ceilings. And it's...
You can get knocked out a lot.
Yeah. It's the most incredible place. It's like stepping back in time. I mean, it feels like a sort of a mini Hampton Court Palace, doesn't it?
It is like a time warp. And that's what gives people... they come different to when they leave, let's put it that way. It has something, I think it's to do with the spring. We have a spring here, which is in the Doomsday Book, and it's a sacred spring, and it heals. It's amazing. It's healed cancer and arthritis and all kinds of problems. And I think there's an energy here that is quite special that seems to heal people.
Hmm.
Nothing to do with me, you know. They think it is, but it isn't. Yeah. It's the house and the ground.
It's a very peaceful place. It's very calming. You certainly sort of get a sense of just quiet when you come here.
Yeah.
And the birds singing in the background. And
yes.
It's very beautiful. Now, if I can take you back, if you don't mind, to your childhood.
My childhood.
Because in just doing a bit of research for today... one of the things I found is that you actually grew up in really quite a privileged household, if the stories are to be correct. But one of the unusual things I read online is that you had struggle reading, not reading, or you had dyslexia, but also that you had trouble talking when you were young.
And I did. I had trouble talking. I had a terrible stammer. That's because when I first went to my first little school, and I was like 3 or 4 up the road in this lane in the countryside, I was writing with my left hand. And by the way, I was very proud of this left hand business because my father only wanted 4 children for a tennis four that he could coach up to be champions. And he wanted a left hander because they're the best. And I came along the third in a row. And I was a left-hander. I caught a ball with my left hand. And my father said, Pussycat's caught a ball in her left hand. Come here. And everybody congratulated me. And I was swung around the garden because I had this left-hand thing, you know. And I was cock of the walk. And then I went to school and I was writing with my left hand. And the teacher comes up the aisle and says, no, Sarah, we write with the right hand. So that put me in a swirl. You know, Daddy says I'm a champion because of my left hand. Teacher says I can't write with my left hand. I must write with my right. So I went into a sort of dyslexic thing from then on, really. Couldn't speak and couldn't read or anything, really.
So did you literally didn't speak until about the age of 9?
Oh, no, I spoke. But On. And so it is a hereditary thing. My father did, and his father did.
Okay.
He was an orator, my father's father, and he had a terrible stone. So it is also in you.
Yeah. And how did you fix that? What was the process, or did it just happen?
I wish the king had gone to my lady. Because when I was 9 at the PNEU school in Chelmsford, the teacher said to Mummy, look, she can't go on like this. She keeps running out of the class when it's her turn to read. She just isn't... You know, she isn't functioning. What are you going to do about it? So Mummy said, well, what would you do? And he said, well, there's this lady who lives quite locally, then she might be able to help. So I went to this little cottage with hollyhocks and sweet little lady with a bum at the back, and I rather fell for her, actually. And I don't fall for many, but I did rather like her. Perhaps it was the hollyhocks. Anyway, she said, now, what you're going to do is you're going to learn this piece, an audition piece, from the Barracks of Wimpole Street. And I had to learn it for next week. Well, that's impossible. Because Mummy wasn't going to help me. Daddy wasn't going to help me. But I was great friends with Marge, who was the cowhand's daughter up at the farm. And she sat down with me, and she was very, very patient and very loving. And I learnt it. And when I went back next week, I didn't stammer. Because it was coming out of a different drawer in my brain. You see, it was coming through a memory drawer and not the creative drawer.
Okay.
And you normally stammer because your thoughts are going too fast for your mouth. So from that day forth, I was liberated. So I learnt my day off by heart before I lived it. So I learnt to say, I'm very well today, how are you? And if it came from my memory bank, I didn't stammer. Of course, and tunes and music. You don't stammer if you're singing a song, you see, because that's coming out of your memory and not your creative draw. So that's how I learned. And of course, because I had to learn everything off my heart in order not to get mocked and teased and all that sort of thing. Mind you, you know, this bullying thing, is it really so horrific? Why can't you just kick him in the nuts?
Well, I mean, you were quite an unusual child. I mean, is it true that you were expelled from, I think, well, at least one school. And, I mean, there's an interesting story about the Queen Mum, isn't there?
What happened was I was transplanted from my trees and my animals, which was my happiness, really, genuinely. I mean, my trees matter to me as much as human beings, actually. And when I was young, I hugged them. I was always up in them, climbing as high as I could go. And I was so close to my trees and indeed all the animals. And my parents got very worried about this and said, we can't let her go on like this. I wouldn't socialise with other children. I was so happy. They didn't see that I was happy. They just saw that I was nuts. So they think we'd better take her away from trees and all her animals. So I was sent to Rodine, which is on the cliff at Brighton, if you've ever seen the monstrous prison of a school, where there was not a single tree or animal inside. And they thought that was a good wheeze. And I went downhill very swiftly.
Mm. And you did not enjoy your time there?
I did not. Okay. No. So we were told one day, I was then 11, told the Queen Mother, I went when I was just 9, which is much too young to be shoveling people away from home. Anyway, there we are, that's what happened. And there I was, the Queen Mother coming, and we were given 3 weeks to practice, because if she was to address us when she came, we had to curtsy, say, Mom, answer her question, Mom, curtsy. So the whole school was on the downs, bobbing away, rehearsing the moment the Queen Mother was going to do that. And the big day came, and I was in the junior house. Next door to me was my best friend, Lanky. And the Queen Mother drove up in her Daimler in 2 shades of blue. She got out. She was just all a poem of blue. All different shades going from turquoise to more sky. And I couldn't believe the beauty with her feathers in her hat. And she came straight up to us, because we were in the front row, I suppose, being juniors. And she said to Lanky, "And how do you like it here?" And Lanky said, "Curtsy, Mom. I love it, Mom, curtsy." "Oh, good, 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 good. And you, how do you like it here?" And I looked into those periwinkle eyes and I said, "Mom, I hate it, Mom, curtsy." And she went, "Oh," wagging her finger with such a twinkle in her eye, as if to say, "You're right on, lady, yeah, yeah. You got it right." But I didn't realise was that behind her was Pikey, who was housemistress, and housemistress must have told the horror, who was headmistress, called Miss Horribin. With a name like that, you're going to be called the horror, aren't you?
Okay.
And then in chapel next Sunday, it was a packed it was, all the teachers, all hundreds of children. I mean, "Will the," and she has a flat hat with a tassel and a black, like a crow, in her pulpit. "Will the girl who told the Queen Mother she hated rode in school please stand up?" And I looked around to see who could possibly have said such a thing. But they pushed me forward, so I walked up the aisle, and I'll never forget that walk up the aisle, you know, to see her blooming above me. And she said, "You know, Miles, you've got to learn to pull your socks up." So I bent down and picked them up.
Oh.
The whole place went up in hysterical laughter, you know. And I thought, well, that's the way forward. And yet I've never done a comedy. But it was the laughter that turned me on to the whole thing, actually. And then she'd come to my house afterwards, so I went to her house and I was expelled.
And so, you were happy, I guess.
Well, I said, "Can I leave now?"
Yes.
She said, "No, you'll leave at the end of term." So that was it.
And I mean, you had your father, by all means, was very successful.
Yes, he designed steelworks all over the world.
Yeah,
those carbuncles, as Prince Charles calls them.
So actually, you did grow up in quite a privileged household, well, in from a monetary point of view, at least. I mean, how did that affect you actually as an adult, having such a
Well, it didn't help really. When I first went to RADA, I remember we all sat in a circle, and there were sort of 50 of us newcomers. No, yes, I think it was 50. And we all sat in a circle, and we had to go around saying, "Gold, gold, gold, bright and yellow, hard and cold." That's pretty much standard English, that was, I think, roughly. So everybody went round and said, "Gold, gold, gold, bright and yellow one, gold, 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 bright and yellow one, gold, 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 bright and yellow one, gold." And right, it came to my turn, and of course I was so innocent in a way, I said, "Gold, gold, gold, bright and yellow, hard and cold." Ah! From then on, I'd had it.
Yeah.
"Can we go to rehearsal, Sarah? Can we go, Sarah?" Because, of course, it was the end of that era, and we're now coming in to the whole new era of working class greatness, which is quite right, too. And so it was interesting, and I went for an audition for The Kitchen by Arnold Wesker, and my agent said to me, "Now, Sarah, don't tell them your father is successful and you come from a privileged background. Say your father is a dustman or whatever you want, but don't mention your background." So I had to go to auditions and lie about not being posh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it is a nightmare being posh, you know.
Mm.
People absolutely hate it today. The aristocracy must have a terrible time. They hardly dare go out. And if they do go up, they talk like that, you know, and they dress down and they talk like that, so they don't get crucified.
And you lived in London as a child?
No, no.
No?
No, no. We lived in the countryside. I'm a country girl, born and bred, thank God.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. And your father was not married to your mother?
No, because we didn't find out that until quite late, no.
Really?
Well, his first wife wouldn't give him a divorce, apparently. She was an Indian lady and wouldn't divorce him. So we were all out of wedlock. My youngest sister, Nessie, she's born in wedlock.
Okay. The interesting thing about your family history is that you mentioned to me when I saw you, I should tell everybody that we've known each other for quite a few years now, and when I was last here at your house, you mentioned the fact that you are related somehow to the royal family, and this intrigues me, what the line is there.
Well, it's very simple, really. My great-grandfather was Francis, Duke of Teck, Queen Mary's brother. He was called Francis. He liked to sow his wild oats all over the place, and he went to the White Lodge at Richmond, where he stayed a lot, and threw his sperm at the seamstress, who produced my grandfather.
I see.
And if you're an acknowledged bastard, you're called Fitzwilliam, Fitzherbert, Fitzwhatever. If you're unacknowledged, you're given the name of Remnant, which is the end of a piece of old cloth. So my father was, my grandfather was Frank Francis Remnant. Mm. And my mother was very poor, came from a very humble background in the East End. And they had this doll's house in the drawing room, Queen Mary's doll's house, which was there all my mother's childhood. It was very difficult for my mother, and I feel very sorry for her, actually.
What happened to the doll's house?
I don't know.
Really?
My mother doesn't know either. Suddenly it wasn't there anymore, and she doesn't know why.
Hmm.
So I never found out the answer to that. But one of her last words to me were, please find out, get the truth acknowledged, because it's ruined my life. It's a very difficult thing if you're very poor, and yet you know you come from this background.
So that makes you a second cousin once removed from the Queen. Is that?
I don't know. I haven't worked it out. I'm no good at that sort of thing. Yeah. And actually, I don't really care much myself, but I do care for my mother, whose life was put... It's a very difficult thing to live with, actually, when you're told who you are, and yet you're so poor, really.
But you've met members of the royal family, haven't you?
I have.
And have you ever brought this up?
Never.
Okay.
But what was interesting, there's a TV programme called... BBC,
Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah. And the very beginning of that, before it even started, they came to interview me. And that was okay. And then he came back, he said, yes, 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 everything is right. It all works out, it all is very good. We found somebody from the House of Teck, and we'd like to have your DNA. And then we can match that up. So I was thrilled. Now, finally, somebody's believing it. So they sent a little package in the post, and I did my own DNA from my cheeks and put it back and sent it off. I never heard another word.
Really?
Not for the BBC. They've got my DNA, you know.
Have you never chased it up?
No.
Why
I don't
not?
I don't chase anything up. Made a vow. I'd never sue. I'd never just get on with living. don't be a victim. Move on, you know. So that all goes into victim area for me.
Okay.
And I won't do it, but I wouldn't mind my DNA back. Because that was taken under false pretenses, yep, obviously. Yep.
So after a colourful childhood, you ended up...
Oh, by the way, my brother went into this, and he went to the Somerset House where all the records are kept, and the page where it should have it, it's been torn out. So we have... I don't exist. Go check in Somerset House.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't exist.
I mean, that... Okay. All right. So this is the first thing. If this were me and this was happening to me, I would be sufficiently intrigued by all of this that I would say, screw my lifetime method of not chasing things up, because I want to find out about my family history. And I know.
And there's four of us.
Hmm?
And nobody's doing it, except my brother went as far as Somerset House, and when he saw the page was missing, he thought, wow, this is something heavy. But we did nothing more.
Fair enough. Perhaps one day...
There are so many things I should be doing that for. I spent my whole life looking things up if I were to...
Yeah.
Every time I've been badly damaged by falsehood.
Mm. So you went to RADA at the age of 15, I think.
I was expelled from my next school too, so therefore I went to a place, my mother was tearing her hair out, so I went to a school in London called the Arts Educational, because I was quite good at ballet. And my
so
mother,
that's Arts Ed in West London?
Yes.
In Chiswick?
No, it was Marble Arch at the time, the Arts Educational. It was then in Marble Arch. The problem with, if you want to be a ballet dancer, you have to know left from right. And when the teacher said, now we're going to start on our left foot, one, two, three, left, right, I don't know the difference, you see. So by the time I've worked out which is my left foot, it's too late. So I was pushed out of that as well. So Mummy lied about my age and put me to RADA, where I got in. I got a very good wheeze for getting in, actually. I'm rather proud of how I got into RADA. Well, I didn't believe I was an actress at all. I didn't want to act. I wanted to be a show jumper. That was my life. I was a show jumper. Horses, that's my life. But Mummy had seen me playing Shylock in Merchant of Venice, and she thought I was so good that I should be pushed in that direction. So she pushed me into RADA and lied about my age, and I was so absolutely terrified, because you go on the stage, you know, and there's nobody, you can't see anything, absolutely black. What are you going to be doing for us today, says a voice. And I said, well, I'm going to be doing a little bit from The Ideal Husband and then a little bit from Romeo and Juliet. So I'll do Ideal Husband first. And I said, oh, I need two more chairs, please. I said, what? Two more chairs, please, for my... Oh, all right, two more chairs. So there's a terrible puffle and puffle while they find two more chairs to come on stage. So the chairs finally came on stage. And I said, thank you so much. I'm sorry if I've caused anybody any bother over that. Thank you so much. And then I did my piece, and I didn't need any chairs at all, you see.
You didn't use them at all?
So I think at the end of the day, they go through all the names. They can't remember anybody.
And they remember you because of the chair. They are.
Exactly so.
Yeah.
That girl who asked for chairs, yeah. You know, that's a bit cheeky, isn't it?
That's so, very clever.
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't. I mean, I sit on the other side, you know, I'm quite often on audition panels for things. And
are you?
Well, yes. And, you know, the hardest thing about sitting there being on an audition panel, well, A, is keeping your mind awake, you know, after you've seen the 41st. Of something, then you start getting a little bored, no matter how wonderful the performance may be. But, you know, it's very difficult to keep awake, but it's even harder to try and remember who is who. So I love that. I think if there's any young budding actress or actor...
Go for it.
Yes, go for it.
Do the chair trick.
Do the chair trick. Okay, so you were at RADA for how long? 2 years, 3 years?
2 years, but... Okay. You won't believe this, but I was thrown out of RADA. Okay.
Well, no, I would believe it. Absolutely. What did you do?
I didn't turn up.
Okay.
I was having such a wonderful life. And this is me all the way through. Life has always come before everything else. Living life to the hilt. That's the whole thing, really. That's where God is, in the hilt.
So you didn't turn up, so you got expelled from RADA. But obviously you went on to become an actress. So what was the first gig you had after
leaving
RADA?
Well, when I was at RADA, there was a lovely guy there called Eddie Fox, Fox family. And he was one head of me, the next tier up. And he said, you know, you should meet my brother. You'd get on like a house on fire. His brother was Willie Fox, who turned into James Fox. And his father, their father, was Robin Fox, who was the greatest agent, probably, of all time. And he, while I was still at RADA, I was just turned 16, I think, or maybe I was still 15, I don't know, said, I've got your walk-on part in The Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone. You ought to go to Elstree Studios, you go in the door, you go to the desk, you say, I've come for the walk-on part, my name is Sarah Miles, could I have my key? And then you go up to wherever the key fits, and that's your... You sit there and wait for the costume person to come and give you your costume. So in I went, exactly as I was told, got my key, went up, and my key went in a door which said Lottie Lenier. So I checked the key, no, same key, I'm going in. And as I was putting the key in the lock, there's a tap on my shoulder. And I looked down, because it was down, I had to look, and that was Vivien Leigh. You can't go in there. That's Lottie Lenier's dressing room. I said, I'm well aware it is. But I was told to collect my key from my agent at the door and to go and put it in the key, in the number that it fits. And I said, if you say it, look, it says 203, 203. So this is where I'm going. You have to go down and double check, please. This is not possible. I said, I'm awfully sorry, but I suggest that you go down and check because I'm going in. So in I went, and indeed, it had everything in it of Lottie Lenier's, her powder puff, her family pictures and everything in it. Kurt Vowell, blah, 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 blah. So I sat there quietly, waiting for the next move, which would be for the wardrobe to come in and dress me, my agent said. Well, do you know that thing when you knock and enter? I've had it happen twice in my life that's brought disaster. If you're going to go into a room, surely you knock and you wait for come in.
Yes.
But when you knock and you enter at the same time, I find that quite rude.
Yeah.
Anyhow, in she flowed, again, Vivien. She said, well, here's a list of colours that you can't wear. And she handed over a list of colours and disappeared. So I looked down this list of colours, and the only colour on there that wasn't on there was black. Then I had to wait for Bumble Dorton. She was very famous. She was Vivien Leigh's best friend, and she was also a costume woman. She designed clothes for movies. So in she came. She said, oh, hello, hello, I'm Bumble Dorton. I said, hello, Bumble, I've heard a lot about you, blah, blah. She said, come, let's go into, let's go and see what we can put you in. You've got a nice little figure. We'll get something exciting for you. I hadn't yet given her bad news about the list of colours, you see. So in we went to the... She said, now what... How about that little pink thing up there? I said, oh, that's beautiful. Oh, yes, I'd like to try that on. And she said, and there's this one here, this little green one. Oh, that's charming. And she was busily getting them all. And I said, I think I ought to tell you something. Vivien came into my dressing room and told me I can only wear black. She says, what? I said, well, here's a list of colours she gave me that I mustn't wear. As she went away reading it, she said, fucking bitch.
So that was a film?
That was a film called The Romans Bring Mrs. opposite Warren Beatty.
Okay.
I got down to the actual set of the stage where they were shooting, and there was Vivien sitting in her chair with Vivien Leigh on it, and him with his name on it, and I was just sitting on any old chair, you know. I was a walk-on, you know. And he came off his chair toward me with Esquire magazine and the cover with his face on it. I'll never forget that. Something you never forget, do you? It was this walking being coming toward me with the magazine with his face on it. He said, hi, I'm Warren Beatty. And that's what she was upset about, you know, because Warren was having an affair with her and she was scared that I might take him from her. But she would have been absolutely safe because I have never been after Warren Beatty in my life. Yeah. Not my bag of bones.
But one of the first films, I think, that you had a main role in was Term of Trial.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Correct. And you've done well.
Oh, thank you very much. I try, occasionally. And you were still very young, weren't you, when you filmed that?
I just want to go back a minute. Can I?
Yes.
I'll come forward to that. Okay. I don't want to avoid that. I just want to say that my childhood, it was the 40s and the 50s, and people were so happy. We had heavy rationing, and people were healthy, skinny, and full of beans. We were full of joy. There was so much love around. I cannot tell you. And rationing is very good for you because it works.
Mm.
You're healthy and you're thin.
Yeah.
Okay, what was your last question again?
Term of Trial.
That's another funny story, actually. Got quite a few odd stories.
That's right. So you were still young when you
I was 17 when I filmed Time Trial. Yeah.
Which is incredibly young.
It is incredibly young. On the cusp of 18, though, because we shot over Christmas, so it hit my birthday.
Yeah. But that was with Sir Laurence Olivier.
Laurence Olivier and Terry Stamp and Simon Signore. Very posh, you know. Very French. Very good. Classy woman. I like very much Simon Signore.
and this was an important film, wasn't it, for you in a strange way, because you spent a lot of time, obviously, with Laurence Olivier and got to know him very well.
Very well indeed.
And you eventually became lovers.
Well, not eventually, actually. What happened was really on the film we were shooting in Paris. It's so odd life, isn't it? But we were doing this scene in the Tuileries Gardens in the film where I wouldn't go into the Louvre because I was feeling dizzy because I wanted him to take... Because it's about a girl who falls in love with her teacher. And I was very much in love with Mr. Weir, he was called in the film. And so I managed to get him out of the Louvre to take me alone. So you go and have a drink, a cup of tea in the Tuileries Gardens. And it was snowing that day, and it was meant to be spring. So they had to sew all these leaves on these bare trees and make it look like spring. Oh. But then the snow started, and it really came down quite heavy. Now, the funny thing was that, I don't know whether you know this, perhaps you don't, but if you wear a wig, the snow can't melt.
Oh, really?
Because it's got hasn't got the warmth of your head.
Yes, of course.
So we were sitting there in this love scene, really, and the snow was piling up on Larry's head, and it was piling up on my head. And the director, Peter Renfield, said, "Enough, it's a wrap, we can do no more today, go home." See? And this was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so Larry and I went. He took me to... what was it called? Crazy Horse Saloon. Have you heard of that?
I haven't, no.
Oh, my God. The Crazy Horse Saloon. I'd never, ever experienced anything like it. Because you're sitting there and I was quite young, you know, and these beautiful women come on and do striptease. And there was one that came on. Did she not know how to do striptease? She was fantastic. I said, "Now that's what it's all about." He said, "It is, except look closely," said Larry. And I looked close. I said, "Well, come on, I'll introduce you." So we go around afterwards, and it was a guy, you know.
Oh, okay.
With two children. And he sticks it all back up there.
Yeah.
Sticks it all back. He was so beautiful, and he was so charming. He was a divine man, and he was the best one of the lot. But what he did was he winked at me on stage, you know, from where he was doing his strip thing. He looked down and he gave me a wink, and I said to him, "Why is he winking?" I said, "I'll show you." That's what I forgot to tell you that bit. So that's how we went round. And so that was really the beginning of it all, really.
And how long did that go on for?
Off and on until I met Robert Bolt. Okay. Off and on for, I think it was almost 7 years.
Okay.
And of course, it also added and to me being a recluse.
And it never came out. It was something which was highly secret. And
I'm deeply proud of this fact. I mean, if you got points for being a good mistress, I reckon I'm up there. The only person that knew was my mother because she caught us together. So she knew. But apart from that, nobody did.
Mm.
But it did keep me at home all the time because I was waiting for that phone call.
Yeah.
And that can be quite lonely, really.
Mm. And do you think, looking back on that, I mean, I get the sense that you're not a person who has many regrets. I get the sense that you're a person who is sort of...
I do regret that I kept it from my boyfriends, because he said I must keep my boyfriends, because, of course, I couldn't see him all that often, because he's so busy. So I sort of did keep it from who I was with at the time, which is not good.
Hmm.
You know, that I'm more ashamed of that than anything.
Did that change anything to do with your career? Did it? Do you feel like it harmed you?
Nobody knew.
Okay. Yeah.
Nobody knew. No. So.
It was what it was.
It was what it was. Yeah. Nobody knew.
And it didn't. And it wasn't public until after his death.
It came public because he was very sure. He's an extraordinary man, you know. Let me just tell you one thing. Energy, we all possess a certain energy around us, and some people have a lot more than others. I don't know why that is. We have yet to find out why that is. It doesn't mean you're superior or inferior. It just means you're born with more energy than normal. And the two people in my life who I reckon, and I've met some very powerful, you know, extraordinary human beings. I've been very privileged in that, I have to say. I feel so lucky to have met the great ones. But my father and Laurence Olivier are the two most more energy than anybody else I've ever met. My father was an amazing man. He was a fantastic tennis player, fantastic at every game he played. He was a warrior. He got the military cross. His desk was stuffed full of medals, yet he never told us anything about it all, except he loved his horse, Kitty. And one day, in a charge, Kitty was shot from under him. And he went down and he cradled Kitty's head in his arms. And an officer came by and said, jump aboard, jump aboard. And he says, no, I'm staying with my horse. And he stayed with his horse until he died. But that's not just it. It was just his fearlessness, his wit, his humour, his energy, his passion, his painting, his sculpturing, carving, gardening, playing games. He was just endless, you know, and going to work from 8 to 5 every day. Mm.
But energy is a very important thing in your life, isn't it? You...
Very much so.
Here at home, you run.
I think we're all going to really turn into knowing. I mean, understanding more about vibration and frequency, because it's all about vibration and how you, if you are fond of, if you meet somebody who you quite like, it's because you're actually harmonising in the same vibration, and we're beginning to learn a bit more about this now.
Sarah, does it worry you that people might listen to something like that and go, God, what is she talking about? That's quite a nutty thing to say. Does that concern you?
Yeah, I think that I'll have the last laugh, because when I'm dead and your this little thing you're doing now goes out in 20 years' time, they'll say, oh, blimey.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm happy.
Fine. I love it. Good. So what happened after term of trial? That was really the start of your career.
What, sorry?
The film, Term of Trial, that was, you know, a real platform for your career.
Yes.
You know, so what happened after that?
It also gave me a very good idea of what crap all these critics are, really, from top to toe. Because when that film came out, they slaughtered Larry. Oh, he can't play an ordinary man. He's this new, great newcomer called Sarah Miles. Watch out for her. She's something special. She wipes the floor with him. You know, go see the film again and watch Larry in Term of Trial. It's such cruelty. It's so incorrect.
Hmm.
You know?
But what did you do after that, after the film?
I did a film with Larry Harvey called The Ceremony in Toledo. Lots of... John Ireland was in it, all kinds of funny people. I was under contract, you see, to Jimmy Wolfe, who made Term of Trial, so I had to often do what he told me to do.
Sorry, who is Jimmy Wolfe?
He was a big film producer, and he was also having an affair with Larry Harvey, and that's how I got stuck with that film.
Forgive me, but in those days then, because I'm not sure it's like that now, I mean, maybe it still is, I don't know, but so in those days you were contracted to a studio or to a producer?
Yes.
So you could not go and do whatever film you wanted with whomever you wanted. You were...
Well, I sort of could, but I wasn't... It wouldn't have been a good thing to do.
Okay.
I wasn't forbidden. I just shouldn't.
Right. But what would happen to you if you did?
Well, I did. In fact, I did. He wanted me to do... oddly enough, it wasn't a film. He wanted to ship me out and do The Rivals in the West End with Ralph Richardson. You know, Ralphie. Can I just go into Ralphie? Do you know who I mean by Ralph Richardson?
No.
You don't? Haven't heard of Ralph Richardson?
I'm sorry.
My God.
I know.
There are three knights of the English theatre.
Right.
Laurence Olivier.
Yes.
John Gielgud.
Yes.
And Ralph Richardson.
Okay.
And both Laurence Olivier and John Gielgud were frightened of Ralphie.
Really?
He was the best of the lot, really.
Really?
Mm. because he had innocence and they didn't. But anyway.
So just talking about John Gielgud, I've got something written down here. I just want to read it out. Did he say to you, and I just want to really clarify this, did you know you have a bottom just like a boy, two poached eggs in a handkerchief?
Yes. That's why we were... Because that's how I went straight from RADA into the West End. I didn't go to have a trial. I went into this play directed by John because he saw me at RADA because I was reinstated, having been expelled. They reinstated me. And I got this wonderful part of a showy stepdaughter in Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author. And John Gielgud was out front and put me straight into the West End opposite my beloved Margaret Rutherford. This is a wonderful story, actually. I have to say this story because it's so funny. So I'm suddenly in the West End, you know, and we're touring around England and Ireland with this piece of crap called Dazzling Prospect. And everybody who has got any intelligence could see the play wasn't a great play. But it was written by Binky Beaumont. Have you heard of Binky Beaumont?
No.
My God.
Sorry.
He was the greatest impresario the West End's ever had. Every single play and musical was Binky Beaumont's.
Okay.
He was the ace. We don't have anybody like that anymore. But he kind of ran the whole of the West End. He was that powerful. And his boyfriend had written this play. And that boyfriend was also a boyfriend of John Gielgud's. So the three of them got this play and put it on for his sake, the boyfriend. So we got to the West End, and we were quite used to people not much liking the play, but we got to the West End to the Globe Theatre, which is now the Gielgud Theatre, oddly enough. And there was a weird feeling on stage, and it came to the interval, so I went into Margaret. I said, Margaret, what's happening out there? It sounds very weird out there. It seems very weird. She said, darling, if you think it's weird now, just wait for the curtain call. I thought, blimey, this is serious stuff. So the curtain call came, and the curtains opened, and the booing was so immense.
Oh, wow.
That the stage manager came around and said, shall I bring down the curtain? And Margaret Rutherford said, no, we shall stand here until they run out of ammunition. So we stood there while we had some tomatoes and things thrown at us. It was amazing. And Binky Beaumont came around afterwards and said, I'm very, very sorry this has happened. I'll explain to you why. There was a play on before you, which was called A Man for All Seasons by a man called Robert Bolt. And we took the play off too soon to put on this play, and people are very angry about it. And I've only got myself to say sorry. I'm so, so sorry. And that was the last time. We made theatrical history because you weren't allowed to take food up to the gods from then on.
Ah, really?
Yes. So I made theatrical history.
And there's a nice sort of... a nice little side story, of course, with that, with the fact that the play that came off too early was by your to-be husband.
Yes.
Twice to-be husband.
Yeah. Just going back to Larry.
Written in the stars.
What?
Written in the stars.
Written in the stars. Yeah. It is strange, that, isn't it, how things kick in.
It certainly is.
You just don't know how the pattern's going to
come
around.
Yeah.
But I just want to say one little quick thing about... oh, no, it doesn't matter.
No, go on.
What?
It's fine. About Larry.
Yes, I was going to say something about Larry. A man came here the other day who was doing the ultimate book on him and Vivian Lee.
Right.
And he said, no, you don't have any letters of Larry's at all. I said, I'm awfully sorry, I don't have any. He said, that's very odd, isn't it? I said, why? He said, well, he liked to write. And I said, well, you know, it was quite secret stuff, really. Mm. And I suppose he didn't, you know, want it known. So he went away, but thinking, oh, well, I haven't got any letters. If I had letters, I'd have put them in my own book, wouldn't I?
Mm. Yeah, of course.
Well, Jeeves was upstairs in the attic the other day, clearing it out. And he came on 13 letters from Larry Olivier in his own hand. I'd forgotten all about it.
Really?
I'd forgotten all about it. Those letters had been there forever, and I didn't even think... Now, that's is screwy.
Wow. So did you send them on?
What? No, I haven't yet. I'm thinking about it. I don't know whether to or not.
Wow.
I don't know whether or not. I'm thinking about whether I should or not.
Hmm.
Because then, how does that work then? He has to pay me for them? What happens?
I have no idea.
I don't know either. I'm not sure what Larry would want that.
Hmm.
That's the thing, you see. He said I can write about him 5 years after his death.
Hmm.
But Jeeves couldn't believe it. He said, look at all this, look at these, in his own hand, and you didn't know you had them.
Jeeves, I should say, just to clarify, is your friend who helps you out around the house and is...
Oh, Jeeves, yes. Jeeves helps me, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Oh, but Larry came back again.
Yes.
He came back after I divorced Robert, after we broke up, not I divorced, but we broke up. And I was living in LA. He came back.
Okay.
So we had another little...
So let's... Before we get there, so you've done the term of trial.
Yeah.
You've done plays and you've now established yourself...
As an expulsion.
And at some point, you then had a... You married Robert Blott. The playwright. That was at 1967?
Yes. I'm not very good at numbers.
I think so. I think that was 1967.
Okay, I believe you. I believe you.
I think so. And how did you meet? What was the...
Well, I wouldn't go anywhere. Now, this is where something hit me very hard. Robin Fox was still my agent, the best ever will be. And he wanted me to go out more. To be seen on the town, to go to premieres, wear the clothes, do the thing.
So be more of a celebrity, right. In inverted commas.
And I didn't want to do that at all.
Okay.
So he got very upset. And one day he writes, did you get the invitation to Leslie Carroll's soiree? And I said, yes. He said, well, will you go? I said, oh, no, I've just put it in the bin. He said, and this is what it hit me so hard. He said, Sarah, it's not a matter of talent, you know. It's all a matter of who you know. And do you know, that broke my heart. Can't you see how it should break your heart?
Mm.
If you're not able to get a role by your acting, why should you get it for arse-licking?
Mm.
I find it disgusting, actually. I find the nepotism and the whole thing disgusting.
Is there an argument... that it should be... There are lots of talented people in the world, especially from my experience in my industry, which is music in particular.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of astonishingly talented musicians coming out of colleges around the world every year. And mm-hmm. they would never... ever be enough work for all those talented musicians. It's just not possible. And there are, of course, always some musicians who are not terribly talented, but maybe looked the part, who become successful.
Are good at networking.
And are good at networking. But is it not a combination that actually it should be both? Because just because you've got the talent doesn't necessarily mean that you... have earned or deserve the success that your talent should give you if you are not willing to take part in the whole package.
But what is the whole package? I mean, surely the package is your ability to act, in my case. What else is there? Because that's what I do. I don't arse lick. Why should that be wrong that I decide to be... And also, I think that mystery is very sexy.
Hmm.
I like mystery.
Hmm.
I don't like someone to come up and tell me everything about them in 2 minutes. They have a bad ovary, you know. I really don't want to know about their ovary. I really don't.
Yeah.
Now, what happened to the stiff upper lip also?
Yeah. Well.
God, we need that back.
Yeah.
Anyway, where were we?
I mean, I do understand your point, and talent, of course, should be the fundamental base. But I do wonder, there has to be another reason. I don't see how it can just be talent, because there are so many talented people out there. How you know that there might be.
No, but if you already have a little bit of a thing, like I did have with my first few films.
Yes.
And they're all very different. I'm a chameleon. I'm not a type. I don't get a type.
No, you've not been typecast.
Therefore, I'm an actress.
Yes.
I'm not a star.
Yes.
I prefer to be an actress.
Yes.
And that's what I do.
Yeah.
But if I have to go and ask Lick in order to do what I do, then
that's
thank
not
you.
What you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand what you're coming from too. Mm. If there are so many talented people who deserve to be known, then they've got to get their tongue long and get licking.
Yeah. I mean, I always say the same thing, which is, no, I've been very fortunate enough to have a very busy career so far. You know, I'm 35 now, and I've genuinely not stopped working since I was about 16 years old. And, you know, I'm really lucky for that. But I but personally don't put that down to my talent, if one says that I have talent. I put it down to the fact that I treat me as a musician as a business, and I totally understand that I have to go to meetings, I have to go to certain parties, I have to go to premieres. Do I want to? I'm not very good at that. Do you know what? You could stick me on a stage and have 20,000 people in an audience. I feel so comfortable and at home. I feel really happy and chilled. You put me in a room with 20 people who want to talk, and I want to go and merge like a chameleon into the corner, into the wallpaper, because I really can't handle that very well. But I totally understand that as part of the business, I have to do that and not sit in a practice room 12 hours a day playing Chopin. I guess that's, you know, I look at the peers coming out of the Royal College of Music that I had, and many of them are not in work or have not become musicians.
Yeah.
Not because they're not talented, because they're far more talented than I'll ever be, but because they didn't treat the fact that they're in a business. You know, there are some people who sell socks, there are some people who sell tables, there are some people who sell movies, and there are some people who sell music. It's a business, and that's, you know, it's part of it, and it's just not a very enjoyable part, and it's not the part that most people see, but I do believe it's an important part. And I think it's interesting that you're so strong and self-willed enough to turn around and go, do you know what, I'm not going to do that. Screw it. I'm not going to do that. But let me ask you a very direct question. Do you think not doing that has harmed your career?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I'm a complete idiot. But you see, what I did, why I'm such an idiot, is because I actually have put it into practice a thing called surrender. And this is a ridiculous word. It belongs to the New Age, which has been made purposely dirty word by the media, very cleverly scuffed it up and made it soiled. But in fact, the New Age is the ancient, ancient truths, and nothing to do with the New Age at all, but they don't bother to check it out. So therefore, you've got this New Age, which is the ancient age, the ancient antiquity of esoteric truths. And if you totally surrender, it means you hand yourself body and soul up to a power higher than yourself. You can call it God, you can call it Willy, you can call it pussy, call it whatever you want, doesn't matter. Because I'm not a religious person at all. But I decided I would hand everything over, which means you don't force forward, you don't lay back, do nothing, you stand upright and ready for all. And if you're in that zone of readiness, you will attract that which is right for you. And not any old thing that'll take you onto a different pathway. We all have our own pathway. And if we can rely more on the powers that above us, we will have a better life and a more expanded life, because you are not doing it yourself. Your diary is empty and you're allowing God or whoever to come in there and assist you, because we're all here for a reason. And if we listen, we'll get it. Mm. If we're too noisy, we won't.
Very
you
nice.
Have to. So what I'm saying is, everything I have done since my epiphany in 1973 is surrender.
And what is that epiphany?
Epiphany.
What happened to you?
Difficult to talk about, because you scuff up, because there's no. We haven't got the vocabulary yet to deal with spiritual happenings. We have a thing called energy, which is pathetic because there's so many different kinds of energy. Mm. We need new words for everything.
It's a bit like the Inuits. They have, you know, we have one word for snow and we call it snow. That's it. The Inuits have like 34 different words for snow because it's vital for them, of course, because they live on it all the time. So they need to know, is it snow they can walk on? Is it snow they can dig down into? Is it snow that's going to break? Is it snow that's going to cause a land snowfall, an avalanche is the word I'm looking for. You know, they need the 34 words for snow. We need one. We need snow because we have it once a year and it causes chaos. But you're right, you know, we have energy and energy and that's it.
That's it. Yeah. The Japanese have 14 words for love. We only have one.
Yeah.
Only one word for love in the English language. And I've got a song about it. We love a cup of tea, and I love you, will you marry me? I mean, there's something wrong. Yeah.
So what was the epiphany? What happened?
Well,
it happened on a single day? It was just a general feeling over the whole of the year?
No, it was. I was making a movie.
Okay.
I was making a movie called The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea, opposite Chris Christopherson in Dartmouth. And when I was young, I have to go back a bit here in order for you to understand. If you really want my epiphany, I'll give it to you, but it's not easy and it's not short.
No, that's fine.
If you want it, you have it, but I'm not going to shortcut it because it would be disgracing the beauty of it.
You go.
Okay. Here we go. I was taught how to masturbate at school at Rodine. A friend taught me how you do it. And I thought it was quite nice, actually. And then I got home and I realised that my brothers were doing it too. So I thought, well, I'll do it at home. So I started doing it at home and we called it Is. And my other brother came in one day and saw me doing it and said, Mommy, Mommy, Pussycat's doing it, Is, Pussycat's. So Mommy would come in and get the hairbrush and thwack me with it and say, you will go blind and your hair will fall out. So from then on, every morning, I'd go to the mirror and check my hair. Am I going blind? No, everything cool so far. Didn't cross my mind to stop masturbating. Anyway, then I jump to a school I was at after Rodine, where we go in to have our confirmation lessons. I didn't want to be confirmed, but they had crumpets and a fire, and we were very cold at this school. It was very freezing. So to have crumpets by the fire was so tempting that I thought I'd get confirmed. Mm. So while we were sitting there, while she was reading from the Book of Revelations, this book was being handed around us lot, and it was a chapter on that all this hair falling out and blind was old wives' tales, that it wasn't true. Can you imagine how I felt at that moment? I felt liberated. Liberated. I wasn't going to go blind and my hair wasn't to fall out. So this movie came along and it's from a beautiful novel by Mishima called The Same, A Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea. And it describes so eloquently, so elegantly and gracefully this sequence of this woman at her mirror with scarves and straw hats. And it's also beautifully described. She's sitting there naked, pleasuring herself, whereas behind her, her son, who's a lot of trouble and who's 12 years old, takes out a piece of wood from the wooden wall that separates them and watches her mother, his mother. And because it epitomised the real loneliness of a woman with no husband and an impossible son, and there she is, sitting at the mirror, pleasuring herself. And I thought, yeah, I'll be a vanguard. It hadn't been done yet on film at that point. We hadn't, never been seen. So I thought, I'll go for it. So I did it. Now, what I didn't know while I was doing that sequence was that the director was a man, the whole crew were men. I'd worked with them all before on The Servant, so I knew them all. And I had to come on that stage that day, take my clothes off, and masturbate in front of them all without help from anybody, because the director had already said, I can't help you, I'm not a woman. I didn't eat 2 days beforehand because of the fear. I hadn't quite seen ahead of time how horrific this experience was going to be for me. Because oddly enough, I'm quite a shy person. I know it sounds ridiculous. That's why I don't go anywhere very often, because I'll always say something ridiculous in defence of being frightened and shy. Mm. I'm very, very shy. So the whole thing turned into an absolute nightmare. And the only way I could get out of this was to see whether I'd pulled it off on rushes the next night. If I'd pulled it off, I'd be home free. Because I wanted to do that line. It's nothing to do with pornography. It's to do with erotica, which is a heightening of spirituality, a heightening of sexuality, taking it to another place, not down into dirty porn, but up into the glory of erotica. So next night, went to see Rushes.
I should just say, sorry to stop you, the Rushes, just for people who don't understand, the cuts before it's been edited together.
Yeah, sorry,
no, Rushes are... Just so people understand.
That's
no
right. Worries. You see yesterday's work.
Yeah.
I never go to my movies, ever, but I do see Rushes because you learn. Mm. You can still make up for what you've done wrong. You can put it right, that sort of thing. So as soon as the lights came up afterwards, I knew I'd done it. I knew I succeeded. And I didn't need any of their praise because they're all coming over to me. And I said, no, see you in the morning. No, everybody. And I go out and I walk along the Dartmouth estuary to my cottage, which is on the sea. And as I'm walking along that pavement, this power comes in through my feet. Something quite incredible coming through me, up me. What the? And it's dusk now. We're dusky. And it's coming up through my legs, and it's like I'm aching with this power and this strength like I've never experienced before. I have to hold on to the railings because I'm going to fall over. I am omnipotent at that moment. There's no doubt about it. I am omnipotent. Everything around me, everything I can see, the stars beginning to come out, the fishermen, people, dogs, moon... Everything is linked. I am in the centre of this gigantic cosmic phosphorescent cobweb. Everything is one. Everything. And I'm standing there in this state of complete omnipotence, thinking, fuck, what is happening to me here? And it's quite terrifying. I grasp hold of the railings, trying to get my breath back. And then this voice comes in, first time, made its entrance. And it begins to say things that I was an atheist, by the way, and I wasn't on any drugs because I can't act on drugs. I don't take alcohol. I'm absolutely free of any drugs at all. This voice comes in and begins to tell me that the mind is not the brain. The mind is above the brain, and above the brain is the spirit. Above the spirit is the collective spirit, and then you come to the soul, all leading up to what we are all together in the centre up there. And I couldn't take any of this crap. I mean, I'm an atheist, you know. I thought, I've got to get away from this nutter in my head. I've got to run a mile from this. This is not what I'm about at all. So I just push it all away and I run to my cottage where I know I've got a stew in the bottom of my oven in the warming place. A vegetable stew, I may add, because I'm a vegetarian. So I get to the kitchen and I'm... And go back into the sitting room and light the candle, said the voice. And I said, how do you know I light a candle, whoever you are? Go and light the candle. So I'm forced, not by any, it's just the love in the voice that did it. The love coerced me into going back and doing what I was told. Light the candle. Go and sit the other side of the room. I was doing as I was bid. Because the voice was beautiful. I called it my echo, and it's been my echo ever since. And I sit there, and I'm a long way away from the candle. He says, now, control the flame, it's yours to tame. Control the flame, it's yours to tame. It was doing as I told it. It was getting larger as I willed it larger, and it was getting smaller as I willed it smaller, and on until I said, this is total rubbish. This is hallucination, imagination, make-believe. Whatever it is, this is not happening. And I got very upset with the voice. And then that same energy, that power came up from my feet into my legs, and I'm sitting in the chair, and even the chair's beginning to shake. That right, gather your energy into a fine silky line, and with utter doubtlessness, will the candle out. With this energy coming up through my feet into my body, was a piece of cake. It went right out on cue, that candle, way across the room. And a voice said, death is not the end, life is not the beginning, birth to death is not a straight line, but a circle of spirit spinning. Your life is your message. Sing it, dance it, write it. I went ballistic. I thought I must be a witch. I crawled around my little cottage trying to find a draught, because that sent the candle out. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. And then from then on, my whole life changed.
And have you ever heard that voice again?
Oh, yeah. It's with me all the time. Yeah. I once had it exorcised, actually, because it began to strangle me when I wasn't doing what it wanted. And I was back with Robert then. We came back again. Let me explain to you. I was with Larry for 7 years, Robert for 7 years. We divorced for 7 years. In that 7 years, Larry came back. And then I was back with Robert for 14. So it's all 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7.
So after you were with Robert for 7 years, if you don't mind me asking, why did you fall apart? What happened?
Well, now, this is the bit which I'm not allowed to speak of quite yet, because of the other thing I'm doing which I can't speak of, which is all connected. I will be speaking out about everything quite soon, and it's heavy stuff. It's heavy stuff why Robert and I parted.
Hello, it's me again. Thanks for listening to that. What an incredible lady Sarah is. So that was part one of my chat with Sarah Miles. As Sarah mentioned, we had to stop the conversation there, but actually we didn't. We carried on talking for about another hour and 10 minutes, believe it or not, and that's what will make part two of our chat. Now, for certain reasons, which I'm not going to go into, we can't release part two at the moment, as Sarah mentioned, and I've promised her that that will remain under lock and key until the point she tells me that it's suitable to do so. Part two is really quite a special episode, and I think you'll find it just as thrilling, if not more thrilling, than part one. So it will be published in the future, I hope, later on this year, and as soon as I hear any more about when I'm allowed to release that episode, I'll let you know. I just wanted to remind you that today's podcast is supported by Lat56. Lat56 are an incredible luggage company that really help me travel around the world, making sure my suits don't get crumpled up when I'm going from concert to concert. And quite frankly, these things are indestructible and they look amazing. I'd really recommend them, so please visit lat56.com to see more information about them. Again, if you really liked what you've heard today, please, please go on to Apple Podcasts or any other platform that you've been listening to and write a review. The reviews are really important for me to get a bit of traction for the show, and if you'd like, please do feel free to write to me and let me know if there's anybody in particular you'd like me to interview next, and I'll see what I can do. Apart from that, that's me done for another day, so ciao for now. Thanks very much.
TheBackstageBlog.com